أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وبه نستعين ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. My dear sisters and brothers in Islam and Iman, Salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillah, we're blessed to be able to gather here at this event in the month of Ramadan. It's a special month. It's a special night of this month. It's a Saturday night as well too. And there's a lot of things that we could be doing other than attending religious lectures on such a night. But it's a blessing, it's tawfiq from Allah for us to be gathered here with the mu'mineen and the mu'minat for the purpose of getting closer to God. Before I begin tonight's lecture, I just wanted to recap some of the highlights of what we've been talking about in the last couple of nights. The topic of this series of lectures is revolution of the self. And we said that when we approach this topic from an Islamic perspective, there's no way we can do so without connecting it to Allah. Meaning we want to cause a revolution in the self, to find meaning for ourselves, to find a goal for ourselves and move in that direction. But all that has to be connected to God. And in order for us to connect with Allah, we need to understand those false deities, those false gods that we're currently connected to. Those things that we currently turn to as a source of guidance, as a source of inspiration that are contrary to the guidance of God. And so last night we talked about the sense of success and how from some perspective in the society we live in, there's a false notion of success. We as Muslims believe in the importance of working hard and of being able to provide for ourselves, our families. We believe in the idea of living comfortably from the land. We believe in being able to use like the resources that God has given us for good purposes. But we say that progress isn't just limited to the material dimension, meaning how much I can acquire, how fatter I can get, how much more I can acquire, and basically things related to this earth and this material land that we live in. But true progress is progress that one makes as they advance towards God. Now, what I want to talk about tonight is one of the products of advancement, meaning that when we look at this notion of advancing according to a non-Islamic perspective, one of the features of progress and advancement is something called technology. In fact, if you look at the way that some non-Muslim historians have classified history, the history of humankind, you'll see that one of the classifications that they've made is to define the periods of human history and the progress that humans have made on the basis of their technology. And what I mean by that is that there was one time when human beings used to use stones to be able to accomplish their tasks. And so they called that age the Stone Age. And then human beings advanced from there and they went on to find something called bronze. Now, bronze was something that was easier to extract from the earth, but it let them do more than what they could do with stones. So that age was called the Bronze Age. Now, according to these historians, human beings advanced even further. They made progress. They went from bronze to something even better, which is iron. And human beings entered the Iron Age. And after that, there was different things that took place. There was the medieval age and another time period. And finally, we arrive at our current age. What is the tool, what is the product of humanity that it can be identified with? Some of them say that right now we live in the digital age, or we live in the age of technology, or the information age. Now, before I go on and see if we can explore this a little bit further, I just want to make a comment about this classification. If you think about it, to classify a human being on the basis of the tools that he or she uses, it's a pretty primitive way of looking at a human being. It doesn't take into account that we human beings are not just physical entities. We're composed of a fusion between a soul and a body. If you look at the way that God describes the different stages of humanity, you see that he takes a different approach. He talks about different prophets that were sent and different religions and shari'as that were sent, all of them having the common core of tawhid, until we get to that final and perfect religion that is given to us by that final and perfect prophet, Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Sallallahu ala Muhammad wa alayhi. Okay, that was a pretty weak salawat. So one more time, please, brothers and sisters. Thank you. Now, what I'm discussing is this idea of technology. Today, we live in the age of technology. Is technology a good thing or is it a bad thing? I want you to ask yourself this question. Most of us will say that technology is a good thing. Obviously, technology is something that can help us. It's a good thing. But those of you who thought about it a little bit deeper, you probably came to a different conclusion. You're probably saying to yourselves that, well, technology is something that if it's used for good purposes, then it's good. But if it's used for something which is evil, then it's not good. And when we look at it from an Islamic legal perspective, that's exactly what we say. We say that technology in and of itself is not something which is haram or halal, meaning that it's something which is a means. You can use it for haram or you can use it for halal. Like, for example, for me to use my phone, I can use it for good purposes, I can use it for bad purposes. I want to see if we can look at technology in a little bit more of a sophisticated way. That approach where we just say that it can be something which is good or something which is bad is saying that it's kind of like a glass. Suppose I have a glass in front of me. I can use this glass to drink water. I can use it to drink juice. Or I could use it to drink something which is prohibited, like wine. It's a glass after all. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's just a medium. It's just a means towards something else, which is what I put in that glass. So the glass itself doesn't have any merit either one way or the other. Now, that is a naive way of looking at technology. And this is where I'm asking you, brothers and sisters, to pay attention, because I'm trying to take you along a certain pattern of thinking. That's a very naive way of looking at technology, that, okay, it's just like a glass, whatever you put into it, it's up to you. Let me give you another analogy. Suppose that you're given a spoon. Okay, now this spoon is something that has been built for a certain purpose. If you have, for example, a bowl of soup, right, you can take the spoon and it will do the job, right? It will go, you'll be able to use it to drink and eat that soup. No problem. Now, suppose that I take away that spoon from you, and instead I give you something else. Like, let's say I give you a saw. Now, a saw is a tool, just like a spoon is a tool. But a saw has been constructed for another purpose. Right? A saw is very good in certain situations. I have a piece of wood, I want to make something out of it, I need my saw. But now it's iftar time and you're hungry, you have a bowl of soup in front of you, I take away your spoon and I say, okay, well, that's a tool, I'm going to give you another tool, which is a saw. Use it to drink your soup. You're going to be like, Brother Salim, what are you talking about? Give me my spoon back. Because a spoon is meant for a certain purpose and a saw is meant for another purpose. Even though they are both similar in the fact that they're tools, they're meant to accomplish a purpose. But each one has been constructed for its own goal in mind. Now, this analogy is a powerful analogy, right? When we look at technology, we shouldn't be so naive to say that, wait a minute, every form of technology, yeah, you can use it for something which is good or something which is bad. Bismillah, as long as I have a good intention, I'm going to use it. And I'll use it however, without looking at any other considerations. No, everything that's there has been created for a certain purpose. And it accomplishes certain goals of the people who have put it together. So we need to be more sophisticated in our approach and understand what we're getting ourselves into when we launch into using this technology. And again, this is the age of technology. Right? No time before have we ever, as human beings, been so intertwined with technology. Just some years back, not too long ago, I remember the time when we would actually leave our homes without having our cell phones in our pockets. But right now, if any of you were to realize that you didn't have your phone with you, most of you would probably be really worried, right? You'd be like, oh, what happened to it? You know, how can I possibly survive the next half an hour without checking my email or seeing whatever's going on whatever site or whatever, right? It's something which has become part of our lives. And as we go forward, it's going to become even more part of our lives. You've seen what they're talking about, Google Glass, and I don't know what sort of things that they want to do with technology and how they're bringing it and trying to make it even more part of our lives. So it's important for us to understand the influence it has on us, our thinking patterns, and how it influences our behavior as well. Please recite salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. What I'd like to do, inshallah, is to see if we can look at some of the values that we have when it comes to certain actions and principles from an Islamic perspective and see how these match up with what technology gives us. And in particular, I want to talk about social media, things like Facebook and Twitter, Instagram, other things that people use and are using very frequently, especially in our younger generations. Let's look at a few things that we've learned from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam and some of their students, their true students, the pious and great ulama. There's a report that we can find in the books of hadith about the character of our Prophet. This hadith says that the Prophet, and I'll read the Arabic, his nature was that he was أَشَدُّ حَيَاءً مِنَ الْعَذْرَاءِ فِي خِدْرِهَا. It's a very interesting language that's used there. The person who's saying this, he's saying that when we saw the Prophet, he had so much haya. Now what's haya? Haya is an Islamic value, which is the quality of having shame when shame is called for. The Prophet had so much shame that he, from our perspective, this companion says, he had more shame than a woman would have in front of a man when she's in close quarters with him. That woman who has not experienced contact with a man. Now, what that tells us is that from the companion's perspective, our Prophet was somebody who had this human characteristic of having shame. And all of us are created with this instinct, that there's certain things that we don't talk about with others. Or we talk about them, but with certain select audiences. For example, there's something that I'll only discuss with my parents. There's other things that I'll only discuss with, for example, my guy friends. I won't talk about them with the opposite gender. And similarly, there's certain things that it's a natural thing for us to not want to share them with others. Now, as a side point here, having shame is not something which we should always have. There's sometimes when we're supposed to overcome that shyness and that shame. For example, when it comes to asking a question that we need to know the answer to, there's no shame. You know, I have this problem, I need to ask that question. I go and ask, for example, the alim, and I say, this is my question that I have. Right? Or another one is where if you don't know the answer to something, and it's hard for you to say it, you still have to say, you know, I don't know the answer to this, because that's our responsibility as well. But the point I want to make is that the Prophet was somebody who had this much amount of shame in his interaction with others. And then he goes on to give an example of this. He says that, وَكَانَ إِذَا كَرِهَ شَيْئًا عَرَفْنَاهُ فِي وَجْهِهِ. When he used to dislike something, we would understand that from his face. It wouldn't be necessary for the Prophet to vocalize his dislike for things all the time, because that wasn't appropriate. Sometimes it's better to do things not so openly, not so with so much boldness. You do some things discreetly, and that's the way that the Prophet was. Now, if you take these two characteristics of having shyness when shyness is called for, and of avoiding directly speaking about something we dislike when there's no need to do so, and you take that to social media, and the way that this technology has been created, we have to ask ourselves, how well does that match up? You see that immediately when people dislike something, they're very vocal about it. Right? Even when their opinion isn't even called for, they feel that it's their own prerogative to express their opinion. And when it comes to issues of shame and haya and keeping away from, you know, certain things, you see that all those barriers, or many of them, are broken down in the context of social media. I might, because of the natural division that God has created between the genders, when in real life, right, when I'm out and about, I'm not gonna ever talk to the opposite gender in a way that's inappropriate and in a way that's, you know, would be haram. But in social media, you see that for some reason, many times that barrier is broken, and guys and girls will be very free with each other. That's one example. Let me give you another one. This is from one of the students of the Ahlul Bayt. His name is Allama Tabatabai. Allama Tabatabai was one of the greatest scholars of the recent era. He's the author of one of the greatest works on the Quran, which is known as Tafsir al-Mizan. His daughter writes about her father. She says that he used to speak very little, and he also used to advise others to speak less. He regarded speaking a lot as a sign of a weak intellect. He talked very simply. Sometimes people used to believe that he was just a regular individual and not a scholar or a philosopher. Now again, take this. This is talking about an Islamic value, which is that sometimes it's better not to speak about something. And take that to social media. Is that the way? What is the technology offering us there? Another example from his life. There was one of his students who is alive today, by the name of Ayatollah Amini. When Ayatollah Amini was a student back in the days, he had two teachers. One of them was Allama Tabatabai, and another was Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayh. Imam Khomeini was his teacher in fiqh and usul, and Allama Tabatabai in philosophy. Now he says that I loved these teachers very much. And so one day I wanted to invite them both to my home and cook for them. So, you know, he did so. He invited both of them to his home. He had a dorm room in the Hawza there in Qum. So he has like these two great figures. I don't know, I can't imagine the spiritual power in that room at that time. So he has both of them in the room with him. And he said, I wanted them to get into a debate. I wanted to see who could win out. Right here you have, like, you know, Imam Khomeini, and you have Allama Tabatabai. I wanted them to duke it out. So I purposely started asking them certain questions about some of the complicated philosophical issues. I asked him a question and him a question. I was trying to get them to, you know, kind of sort of spar with each other. But he said that every time I would ask one of them a question, the other one would just listen very, you know, contentedly and just, you know, nod his head and then remain silent. And then I would ask the other one and the other would do the same thing. They would never engage with each other. Because their akhlaq, their level of ethics that they held themselves to was that they felt so humble in the presence of others. Now again, I ask you this question. I mean, you use these media. How well do these qualities map out into social media? Is it the case that there's room for someone to just stay back and not comment, not to express their opinion, especially on things that they're not sure about? Or do we find the opposite, where so many times people are quick to put out things which are based on guesswork and not on fact? So many times you've seen, I'm sure, that somebody will have a question about a religious issue. For some reason, they want to, the way that they get a solution to that, they think, is to just, for example, post something on their profile. They're like, what's the answer to this? And you have all these people then coming and answering, saying, well, I think it's this, I think it's that, you know. Is this a valid way of getting an answer? Why is it that we feel so confident in speaking out about things that we don't know? Let me give you another example from the life of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi as-salam. According to some of the books of history, there was a great companion of Imam Ali alayhi as-salam by the name of Yahya al-Mazini. Now Yahya used to live in Kufa, and he was neighbors with Imam Ali alayhi as-salam. Imam Ali had a daughter by the name of Zainab salamullahi alayha. His neighbor says that all those years that I used to live next to Imam Ali, I never understood what Zainab looked like. I didn't understand how tall she was or what she looked like because of the type of hijab she used to observe. He says that at nighttime, I would sometimes see her coming out of the home. And I would see her, and on her right side, there would be Imam Al-Hasan alayhi salam. On her left side would be Imam Al-Husayn, and in the front would be Imam Ali with the lantern. And they would make their way, this perhaps was in Medina actually, not in Kufa, in Medina. They would make their way to the grave of, I believe, the Prophet, I'm not sure exactly, one of the family members, and she would pay her respects there, and they would come back. Now, there's another report that says that when this daughter of Imam Ali, Zainab salamullahi alayha, when she would go to the grave and actually, you know, pay her respects, Imam Ali would cover the lantern. And one time, Imam Hassan asks his father, he says, why is it that you're covering the lantern when Zainab goes to the grave? He says that I want to do so just to make sure that no one can see her doing that. Now, brothers and sisters, this is the example we have of the type of hijab that was kept by the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wasalam. You might say that, okay, well, this is the Ahlul Bayt, they had a special responsibility. That's fine, that's true. And you might say that, well, there's nothing wrong with a woman if she's dressed in hijab to be out there in the society. That's very much true as well too. And for her to be, you know, getting an education and doing whatever is necessary in order to earn her livelihood, etc. That's true. But still, when we see that the Ahlul Bayt had such a high standard of keeping gender relations intact and not crossing the boundary unnecessarily, then that should teach us something. Right now, you take that and again go to social media. The types of pictures that are put up, the types of videos that are put up, the types of comments that are made about other people's pictures. Sometimes I'm amazed, like sisters who, or brothers who hold themselves to be so, you know, careful when you're with them in person, but when it comes to that realm, it's like they become a different person. The same rules apply in person that they do there. Right? We are not allowed to gaze upon anything with lust, we have to control ourselves. We're not allowed to present ourselves in a way that's provocative and invites other people towards haram. There's certain standards and there's a certain dress code that we have to adhere to, and that applies in the online world as well. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Let me give you another example of a teaching that we have from Islam. This is from Imam Ali alayhi salam. He says the following in a hadith. He says, "Man kanat himmatuhu ma yadkhulu batnuhu, kanat qimatuhu ma yakhruju minhu." What does that mean? It means that one whose entire focus is on what enters his stomach, his value, you know, his true value is that which comes out of his stomach. Now, sometimes you see that people use social media for things like this. Right? It's all about, okay, where did I eat? Which restaurant am I checking into right now? And then when I get there, what am I going to eat? What did I have for my appetizer? What did I have for my meal? I'm taking pictures of that, sharing that with people. What did I cook for dinner today and how well it turned out? What are the recipes? Now, to a certain extent, that's not a problem, right? But when that becomes the focus, right? And like basically, you know, I'm looking at pictures of cats and pictures of food, right? And that's like the limitation of what I use social media for. Then you got to wonder, what's the value of this whole thing? Right? Before I was eating well, and now I have another 10 options I have to choose from because I got all these recipes. Okay, well, did that really help me, right? In growing as a person, what sort of success and what sort of progress is this? One more. This comes from a story of one of the great companions of the Ahlul Bayt by the name of Abu Basir. He says that one time I was teaching Quran to a lady, which is, alhamdulillah, a good thing. He was teaching Quran, how to recite Quran. And it came to a situation where I started joking around with her in an inappropriate way. So, afterwards, I happened to go and visit the fifth Imam, Imam Al-Baqir alayhi salam. And without my saying anything, the Imam asked me, he says that, what is it that you told to that woman? You see, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, they had a particular attention to their Shia. Right? They wanted their Shia to succeed, and it hurts them. It hurts them when their Shias turn away from the path of guidance. He says, what is it that you told that woman? And he says that, well, you know, I said such and such thing to her. And then he started to feel bad about what he did. Being one of the select companions of Imam Al-Baqir, he knew that he had to hold himself to a higher standard. And according to the hadith, he covered his face in shame. There's a side point, that's a lesson for us, brothers and sisters. Because we have an imam as well too, and we know that all of our deeds are presented to him constantly, on a daily basis, according to some narrations, that he sees everything that we do. And so don't we have also a cause to cover our head in shame from time to time as well? He covers his head in shame, and then the imam tells him, don't worry, it's okay, just don't go back to doing that. Right? Don't do that again. You see, something as simple as joking inappropriately is something which hurts the imam of the time. Again, you find on social media that sometimes these barriers just go down and it becomes a free-for-all. Whatever, anybody who wants to say about anything, and it's all about who can say it in the, you know, in the snazziest way possible, right? Who can make more people laugh? Who can get more likes? Who can get more people to follow them? If you look at these type of principles and values that we have in Islam, and there's others as well too, and you take them to technology and social media, I think it gives us room to reflect and see what sort of relationship we want to establish with it. We have to understand that we're not dealing with something which is totally innocent. I'm not saying that it's something that we need to stay away from totally. No, there's a lot of good things that it can be used for as well. But it's not totally innocent. There's a lot of incentives that are there for the people who are running it, for us to go and basically lose ourselves in it. You guys must have seen the recent news about NSA and what the PRISM project, right? Yes, you know what I'm talking about, right? Like the National Security Agency like had a massive project underway to basically spy on people through technology. And they still haven't discovered the extent to which they're spying, but some reports indicate that basically everything that we do, whether it be an email, or whether it be like an online conversation or a chat, all that stuff is potentially being watched on and spied by the government. So there's political incentives for us to do these things. Also, there's economic incentives as well, too. Right? I don't know if you've seen how it is, for example, that Facebook makes money off of us. Right? Right when you're scrolling through your newsfeed, you'll see that they put in ads, right, on different sort of things. When people play games, right, games, you think, oh, they're innocent, right? But games are one of the best ways that they make money out of people. And so that's why you'll see that whenever somebody completes, like, the latest level in a certain game, that happens to come up why is that important to anybody? It's because they want to make money off of you, right? We can't be naive consumers of these. What we have to understand, brothers and sisters, is that in some ways, social media is feeding the biggest idol that exists out there. What is the biggest idol that people worship? Right, far greater than Lat and Uzza and whatever idols they made in the past. What is the biggest idol of today that people worship? It's the idol of their self, the idol of their soul. It's all about me and how people think about me and my forming my image among other people. They use this term, it's called narcissism. You must have heard this before, right? Narcissism, it's interesting. It comes from a Greek background. What happened is that there was, they say this is in Greek folklore, there was a Greek god by the name of Narcissus. And he was supposedly an individual who was very beautiful and very handsome. But he was also very vain and conceited as well too. And he would be very rude to people. Even if they would be enamored with his looks, he would be rude to them. He'd be arrogant towards them. So the goddess of evil, whose name was called Nemesis, decided to take revenge. And she set up a trap for him. She arranged for him to look at his own reflection in a pool of water. So Narcissus looks at himself in the pool of water and he's like, hey, you know, this looks good. This is really beautiful. And he basically fell in love with his own image to the point where he died in that state. He got obsessed with himself. Now that's a story in Greek folklore, right? And then they made a psychological sort of concept out of it as well too. They say that, you know, somebody can be a narcissist, they can be infatuated with their self. But we see that oftentimes the reason why we do things when it comes to technology is about seeing what other people think about us. Sometimes even we can use religious things to attain this. Sometimes people will, for example, take a hadith from the Ahlul Bayt and they'll share it with others. And that's something which is very good, and I encourage that. It's a good thing. But sometimes we do that to see how many people are going to like us for doing that. And that's what we base whether we're happy doing it or not. I mean, sometimes we might get not too much, too many likes, right? And we'll be like, oh man, that wasn't good. But if we get a lot of them, we're like, yeah, okay, that's something which is good. Right? Even on these type of things, we can be tricked. And it can be a thing about ourselves and we becoming obsessed with ourselves. Not that, I'm not saying that there's no room for caring about what other people think about us. No. In Islam, we're told that we should present ourselves well. We should take into account other people's perspective on us. But that's not independent of God. And sometimes it may be the case that other people might think negatively about what we're doing, but we still stay firm in what we're doing because that's what our faith calls us to do. So brothers and sisters, in terms of some practical tips, one thing is that we have to understand that technology is not something which is a safe haven. For example, it's not okay for our children let's say if I have a child, for them to just, you know, go and do whatever they want. There's a lot of sin out there. A lot. In particular, social media is something where the sin of shahwa and following our lusts in a haram way is particularly prevalent. It's very interesting. We have a hadith, we have a verse in the Quran where Allah talks about the people of shahwa, right? People who take their lust as their object of worship. Allah says, God tells us that these people don't only content themselves with following their shahwa and that being their goal in their lives. No. They want to take other people with them as well too. Allah says, وَيُرِيدُ الَّذِينَ يَتَّبِعُونَ الشَّهَوَاتِ أَن تَمِيلُوا مَيْلًا عَظِيمًا. The people who follow their own shahwa want you to swerve in the same direction as well too. They have a campaign to bring you in as well. And I think you'll agree that that's something that's very much found when it comes to social media. Right? One person will like a rock star, right? And everyone else will see it as well too. We're being encouraged to go along the same thing. Just press this one button and it's just a matter of following them, right? What's the big deal? Right? You can follow them and you can follow your religious figures as well too. Right? But this is the beginning of something. It's one step into will be followed by another step and another step. Following shahwa, we're told by our scholars, they say that, look, it when it comes to protecting ourselves against sin, what we need to do is we need to build up our taqwa. Right? We need to build up this resilience within us, this feeling of protection and the state of our soul where we protect ourselves from sinning and the punishment of God. And for the most part, our taqwa is going to be helping us out in different situations that we encounter in our lives. Okay? Like for example, let's say that for some reason there's a bottle of alcohol. Okay? And it just for some reason happens to be in the room that I'm in and nobody else is there. Nowhere in Islam are we told that if there's a bottle of alcohol, a single bottle of alcohol, that we can't be in an enclosed room with that bottle of alcohol. Right? Our taqwa is supposed to protect us in that situation from drinking that alcohol. But there are some areas where it's not enough for us just to rely on our taqwa, but we have to do something to protect our taqwa itself. And one of those areas is when it comes to shahwa, because of the overpowering nature of lust and shahwa. We're told in Islam that, yeah, when it comes to that bottle of alcohol, if you're there in the room alone, it's not wajib on you to leave. But if you're in a room and you're alone and you're with the opposite gender and who's a non-mahram, we're told, and there's no one else there and it's locked up, we're told that the third one who's going to be there is a shaitan. So don't let that happen to you. Right? That's a place where we have to do something to protect our taqwa because of the nature of that situation. And so when it comes to social media, because of that being there, we have to be extra careful about the way we use it. We have to make sure that we control it, not that we let it control us. There was a time when people used to use technology in this way. Look at, just go back some time in history when they created windmills, for example. Okay, windmills were used for a very important purpose, right? Which was to, the wind would come and the mill would, you know, turn, and that would be a way for turning wheat into flour. Very noble purpose, very important, accomplishing something really important, right? Now, people would use these, farmers would use these windmills for to accomplish a goal. But how much attachment did they have to the windmill itself? That's a question we have to ask ourselves. Or was it something that was a really big deal, what color it was and like what model they have, right? It's just a windmill for God's sake, right? You use it for what it is, it's good for, and then you go home and you go on with the rest of your life. The nature of technology today though is something else, it's something different. It's not like that. A lot of times people don't just take it to be something as a means of accomplishing something else, but it becomes the ends in of itself. It becomes something that we occupy ourselves with all the time. When we don't have anything to do, we go on social media. Rather than it being something that we have to accomplish and then we go on to doing what's important. We can't let it overtake us. We can't let it schedule our time for us. We can't let it tell us what to do. We have to use it in a controlled sort of way. If I have a child, it's okay for me to say that your technology time, your screen time is limited to a couple of hours a week, 1 hour a week, 2 hours a week, 3 hours a week. It's okay for me to prevent my children from necessarily using all the latest apps and all the latest technology and to have some sort of understanding of what's going on there because of the nature of the medium itself. The last point I want to make in this regard is that if we spend all of our time on social media, and that's what's happening, you see that, you know, people in their free time, this is what they do, right? They browse the web, they surf this thing, they look at that thing, right? Then it takes us away from accomplishing the more important things in life, right? What happened to like building a family? What happened to spending time together as a family? Even something, I'm not talking about always like praying and doing dua together, although that's important, that's necessary. Right? What about something like playing a board game together, a halal board game, right? That was something of the past. Today, everyone's on their own phone playing their own games. Right? That's not the way we're supposed to be. And other things as well too, for example, reading Quran, right? As a young person in particular, I'm supposed to, I have a responsibility. It's a necessity for me to grow a relationship with this Quran. In hadith, we're told that when a young person reads the Quran, the effect of doing so is that the Quran will come and become part of his or her flesh and blood. It becomes part of who they are. Imagine part of us being the Quran. Now that's something which is incredible. Why do we spend so much time worrying about what people say and spend so little time worrying about what God says? Do we have that relationship with the Quran that we're working on and building on in a regular basis? This is the month to start, brothers and sisters. Finally, I just want to end with a few words of tawassul to the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam. These nights of the month of Ramadan are times for us not to just, you know, eat after a long and hard day of fasting, not just to spend time with the family and the community, but also to remember what's important and reflect on these things. And we need help. We need help from God. We need help from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam to accomplish this great task of having a revolution of the self. Let me begin by sending my salams to the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. As-salamu alaykum ya Ahl Bayt an-Nubuwwah وموضع الرسالة ومعدن العلم ومهبط الوحي We saw how it was the case that the daughter of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Zainab, was such a chaste woman, she was so pious that her father was not willing for any non-mahram to see her. But as the captives of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam were being taken towards the city of Sham, all the people were lined up in the streets to see who are these kharijis who have been captured by the soldiers. Who are these people who dared to revolt against the Khalifa of the time? Who are those people who are being paraded? Who are these women without their head coverings? One of the Shia of the Ahlul Bayt by the name of Sahl ibn Sa'ad sees who these people are. He realizes that they are none other than the women of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam. Among them are the daughters of Imam Hussein and Zainab salamullahi alayha. He comes to one of the daughters of Imam Hussein and asks her, Is there something I can do for you? She tells him, oh, Sahal ibn Sa'ad, please take some money and go to the man who's carrying the head of my father, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and tell him to divert attention from the women. Tell him to move the heads in another location so people will look at them and they will not look at us in our situation with our heads uncovered and nothing to protect ourselves with. ألا لعنة الله على القوم الظالمين وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلب.